On the Edge of the Etheric: Survival After Death, Scientifically Explained, Arthur Findlay. Chapter 1. Introduction. If any man can convince me that I do not think aright, gladly will I change, for I search after truth, by which man never yet was harmed. Marcus Aurelius. I have thought much and pondered long over the strange experiences I have had during the last 12 years, experiences so strange, so foreign to all our accepted order of the phenomena of nature, that I can readily understand the difficulty many must have in accepting my records as true and accurate accounts of what really took place. I can expect only those who have had similar experiences themselves to accept what I am about to tell without question or without doubt. I know that if 13 years ago I myself had been asked to believe these strange accounts, I should have found it impossible to do so. But then my mental development was not sufficiently advanced to enable me to comprehend the subject. I then did not understand that these psychical manifestations, which it has been my privilege to experience, are like the other manifestations of nature, ruled by law and governed by order, and it is only when our knowledge advances sufficiently that this new science is found to harmonize with all that is already known. As I say, I have had strange and wonderful experiences, because I have been brought into contact with a new world, a world which even the greatest thinkers on the subject are only now beginning to comprehend. My position has been a peculiarly privileged one, as 12 years ago I had the good fortune to meet Mr. John C. Sloan, one of the most gifted mediums in this country, and in his presence, when the conditions were suitable, voices quite extraneous to the medium spoke to me, claiming to be those of friends who, in my ignorance, I had looked upon as dead. These voices are not produced by the medium, and they occur, not only when others are present, but also when he and I are alone together. They are not produced by any means of trickery, and I have come, after years of thought, to believe that those we 21 call dead live on as men and women in a duplicate etheric body, and are able to manifest their presence again in this material world of ours, by borrowing from the medium a certain excretion, which emanates from his body. This enables them, for the time being, to materialize their vocal organs and thus vibrate our atmosphere. We must first of all clearly understand that the etheric world is part of this world. That it is all about us. That it is material, though of a substance too fine for our senses normally to appreciate, that here and now we are etheric beings clothed in a physical body, and that death only means a separation of this etheric body from the physical covering. The etheric body is the real and enduring body, an exact duplicate of its physical counterpart. When this is appreciated, it can be more readily understood how, under certain conditions which we do not yet fully understand, it can again clothe itself in physical matter, and behave under the control of mind in a manner similar to ourselves. So long as the thought prevails that the spirit of man is something of the nature of a puff of wind or a fleecy cloud, of no form or substance, so long will incredulity last among those who believe that all that is can be seen and heard, and that nothing exists outside the range of the physical world. To enable those who once lived in this physical world of ours to rematerialize their bodies, composed of this finer etheric substance, certain conditions are necessary. The first is the presence of someone possessing a superfluity of the substance which of recent years has been termed ectoplasm or teleplasm. Whichever word will be ultimately adopted is a matter of no special importance. This individual is termed a medium, though it is believed that most of us have this quality of mediumship in a more or less degree, as we all have this substance within our own bodies. The recognized medium is different from us solely because he or she has this substance to a greater degree than the average individual, and it is thus more easily borrowed by the other world men and women who make use of him or her for the time being. In the case of the direct voice, to which I am now referring, the best results take place in darkness, as light vibrations make it more difficult for this ectoplasm to be built up with sufficient solidity to vibrate the atmosphere. Therefore, though I have heard voices in daylight, yet 22. They are stronger and better developed in the dark or in a red light which has not the same destructive effect as white light. Quiet and harmonious conditions are also essential, and the condition of the atmosphere at times interferes with the results. For example, when the air is heavily charged with electricity, the results are poor, the best manifestations occurring on clear, crisp moonlight nights, when the atmosphere is not too loaded with moisture. At the best, the conditions making speech possible are very delicate, and only by experience can the best results be obtained, but when these do prevail, the manifestations are indeed very wonderful. Voices of all degrees of culture and intonation address the sitter, and their peculiar tones can again be recognized as those pertaining to the individual when living on earth. The skepticism of the sitter may prevail for a time, but if his honest desire for truth takes the first place, conviction is inevitable if the inquiry be pursued. The object of this introduction is, in the first place, to clear away certain prejudices and misconceptions, in the second place to emphasize our colossal ignorance of the universe, and in the third place to stress the great limitations of our sense organs. We should approach this new revelation with minds sufficiently plastic to enable us to readjust our views and put aside any preconceived ideas we may have of what is possible and what is impossible. Before going further, however, let me look back. The history of the Christian Church is typical of all movements, either religious or political. Those in authority pronounced their dicta, and those not in authority had to obey them. It was not in the interests of these rulers to improve the learning or relieve the ignorance of the people, and the people were so ignorant that they could do nothing more than obey those in power. That time is now looked upon as the Dark Ages. But, with the invention of printing, light began to shine into darkness. Then men's minds began to grow and to think. In 1543, Copernicus published his discoveries, and from that date a new outlook began to spread over Europe. We began to comprehend our relationship to the rest of the universe. Then came Kepler, to be followed by Galileo, Leonardo da Vinci, Bruno, Newton, Darwin, and many others who carried forward the torch of learning and helped to dispel the ignorance of their times. They were denounced, excommunicated, and traduced. 23. But still they held to the path of truth. And now we find today every intelligent person accepting their views. It was about the beginning of the present century that a change began to come over scientific thought, in the direction of viewing man not only as a physical but also as a spiritual or psychical being. This was caused by the discovery of the composition of matter, and by the gradual acceptance of psychic phenomena. Matter in the 19th century was looked upon as composed of atoms, little minute lumps of matter which congregated together to make big or little lumps as the case might be, just as a rice pudding is made up of various particles of rice. The discovery of the X-ray brought about a further examination as to the constitution of things we see, and has resulted in the extraordinary discovery that matter is made up of what are called electrons and protons. These are not substances, as we understand the word. They are so minute that it is impossible to get down to them, and in consequence the nature and constitution of matter is only a question of inference. What, then, is the material universe composed of? We really do not know, but there is one thing that scientific thought has begun to comprehend, and that is that the real universe is not the physical universe. In the days before Copernicus, it was thought that the sun, like the moon, circled round the earth, that the stars were points of light hanging from a huge dome, and their size was quite unrealized. The author of Genesis described their creation in six words as a kind of afterthought, and he made the stars also. This earth was thought to be the center of the universe, it was considered to be flat, and that space was empty except for the sun, moon and stars. That is how a child would describe the earth and the universe today. And that is how our ancestors described them 400 years ago. We are today in a somewhat similar transitory period. The average individual would say that what he saw, namely, the earth and all that composes the earth, was real, and that the sun was a real and solid mass, and that space was empty except for the stars and planets. That, most of us would say, is a common sense way of dealing with such a question. What we see and handle is real. What we cannot see and handle is unreal. But just as the earth revolves round the sun and not the sun round the earth, So we are. 24. Being led by science to look on the universe as something completely different from what it appears, and to regard a world unseen as also real, and what is seen as only real to us inhabiting physical bodies. Let me give an example of what I mean. Supposing we were sitting in a church in the dark, never having seen the church, and could see only various glow lights moving slowly in innumerable different directions, everyone would say that the only things real in the church were the lights we saw moving about. That is our position in the universe today. These lights represent the stars, the material universe, but, when the church is bathed in sunlight, the lights we saw are made invisible by the daylight which reveals to us an entirely different aspect. When we are sitting in the dark and look at the points of light moving about, it is the same as looking at the universe with material eyes. When we sit in the dark we think that is all there is in the church, and that there cannot possibly be anything more, but when the daylight comes we see the pulpit, pews, windows and walls. In fact it is an entirely different view which we behold. If two people were writing on what they saw, one during the time of darkness and the other in daylight, they would each give an absolutely different description, and yet it would be the same church and everything would be in the same place. We, in our physical bodies, are looking at the universe from the point of view of people in the church during the time of darkness. That is why a material explanation of the universe, based on the arguments put forward by materialists, is unwise, as they are looking at and considering only the physical universe, whereas the real universe is the etheric, and physical matter is but an intrusion in what we call space where the real universe exists. Space is the real universe. We think it is empty, but it is full of life and growth, a real objective world to its inhabitants. It is when we die and discard our physical body, that we look on the universe from the point of view of the people sitting in the church during the daytime. The human being is composed of body, soul and spirit. The body is what we see, the soul is our mind, and the spirit is our etheric body which is an exact duplicate of our physical body. The etheric body holds our physical body together, and death is only the parting of the etheric body. 25. From the material body. This etheric body carries the mind or soul with it, and then we do not look on the universe from the material standpoint but from the etheric standpoint. The material world becomes of no account, and the etheric world, what we call space, is the only one that counts. From what we know of its constitution it is permanent, while the material universe is constantly changing and decaying. No trace of decay can be found in this etheric universe. Everything is constant and regular. The mind of man is something super etheric, a plastic substance which no one in the physical body is able to explain, but it must be super etheric because it functions, guides and controls the etheric body after death. If it were not super etheric it could be damaged or destroyed by those evilly disposed in the etheric world. They can see the images it forms in our forehead, but they cannot touch it nor harm it. Except that they can see it working, it is completely beyond their reach. The etheric body is the body which holds together the material body on earth, and there is probably an etheric body for every living thing. The mind does not change by death, but only functions in different surroundings. The result is that it is only character and memory which really count, and the reason for continuing to develop our character must receive an impetus when it is known that as we develop here, so shall we be hereafter. Life is something quite apart from physical matter as it appertains to the etheric world. Why or when it entered into conjunction with physical matter we do not know, but there was a time far back in history when a living organism appeared. Then it was that life and thought in the most minute form took birth, and from it has evolved the complicated system of the human body and of all living things. We also do not know when this life was able to retain individuality. All we know is the fact that, so far as human beings are concerned, it can now function apart from the material body. The material world is a transitory and passing world, and matter as we see it is the least important thing in the universe, though to us today it seems to be the most important. The things which are unseen are eternal, those things which are seen are temporal. The 19th century added more to our knowledge of the physical universe than all the previous centuries combined. Today knowledge grows so fast that the mind becomes incapable of assimilating more, and we sometimes think that we have reached the ultimate in what we can learn. The 19th century scientists dealt only with physical matter, and so we came to think that only physical matter existed. Knowledge advances by stages, and each stage is the foundation for the next. The foundation of physical science has certainly been well and truly laid, and the same law and order is found to exist wherever there is physical matter. Physical matter, until comparatively recent times, was considered to be solid, and individuals were believed by Haeckel and Huxley, and the majority of 19th century scientists, to be only physical productions whose thoughts and actions were produced in a purely mechanical manner. Just as there was no room for anything outside the physical world, so there was no place for anything apart from the physical body. All was solid matter, capable of being seen, touched and heard, and subject to certain well understood, immutable laws which governed the universe. In the slow order of evolution it was doubtless wise that this foundation to our knowledge should be so carefully laid. But we were in error in thinking that we had reached the bounds of knowledge and that nothing existed outside our physical senses. Religion and science in those days were poles asunder, while the church was able to keep within its folds only those whose faith exceeded their knowledge. Even theological creeds in time failed to hold the majority, and a blind fatalism settled on religion. The church, no more than the scientist, knew anything of the afterlife. Its heaven was, as the well-known hymn told us, far, far away, so far away indeed that the average thinking man ceased to believe in its existence. If he did, he had a nebulous notion of a new Jerusalem, painted in fantastic colors, the abode of the saved, and of an equally nebulous hell, the abode of the damned. Neither science nor religion knew that there existed around and about this world of ours another world of finer matter where those who died immediately entered, with an etheric body just as tangible and just as real as its physical covering which had returned to the earth from which it, which will command more and more attention as the years roll on. This new science, which today is the Cinderella of all the sciences, will in time take its place as the foremost and greatest of them all. We are on the threshold of a new age of thought. The position which the science of psychics has now reached is due to those pioneers of the past who labored unceasingly in their researches into this hitherto unknown realm of thought. They braved the jeers and contempt of their fellow men, knowing that their labors rested on a sure and certain foundation. During the latter half of last century their discoveries received little attention, but, as the present century advanced, the hitherto incredulous and unbelieving public has been compelled, by the steady accumulation of facts, to modify its former hostile attitude. Consequently, we find today, especially among the younger generation, a much more sympathetic attitude towards the subject. To these early pioneers all honor is due. They were to be found in all sections of the community, though it was those men of outstanding eminence who suffered most from the abuse of an ignorant public. Among the earliest men of scientific eminence, Sir William Crookes and Alfred Russel Wallace will always be remembered for their courage and fortitude in proclaiming a new but unpopular truth. Researches in the phenomena of spiritualism, published by Crookes in 1874, will forever remain a monument to his honesty and courage. Among other famous men of science, who were not ashamed to acknowledge their interest in psychical research, I would mention Lord Rayleigh, Sir Archibald Geikie, Sir J. J. Thompson, Professor Gilbert Murray and Professor William James of Harvard. Another American, Dr. Hislop, who devoted most of his later years to the subject, published his discoveries in several volumes which are of especial value owing to the careful manner in which his facts are recorded. In Europe, Lombroso and Flammarion, after years of study, declared their belief, not only in the phenomena, but also in an etheric world and communication between it and ourselves. Richet, the world-famous French physiologist, in his great work 30 Years of Psychical Research, has accepted the phenomena though he still reserves his opinion as to their interpretation. 29. He, however, already goes a long way on the road most inquirers have travelled, because a few years ago, writing in Nature on the subject of psychic science, he stated his opinion that our intelligence is reached by forces that disclose facts which neither sight, hearing nor touch could reveal. This role of men of science would, however, be incomplete if reference were not made to two of our greatest scientists who have identified themselves with the subject more than any of their contemporaries. I refer to Sir Oliver Lodge and Sir William Barrett, both of whom had the courage of their convictions in the early days, when belief in the reality of psychic phenomena was considered as a crime against all the tenets of orthodox science. I well remember the pleasure it was to Sir William Barrett to deliver a lecture on psychical research to an audience numbering thousands in the St. Andrew's Hall, Glasgow, some years ago. I had the honour to preside, and he mentioned to me, when he saw his audience, that 40 years previously he had addressed the members of the British Association from the same platform on the importance of investigating the then little-known subject of telepathy, but that he had received no support. The whirligig of time, he aptly remarked, had brought about so complete a change that not only had he before him, on the present occasion, a large and sympathetic audience, and on the platform several university professors, but his subject embraced all the phenomena proclaimed as true by the spiritualists 40 years previously, and derided by the British Association of that day. Sir William was one of the founders of the Society for Psychical Research, and maintained his interest in it to the very last, as on the same day as he died he was present at one of its meetings. He was active and his mind was keen to the last. Every year that passed only strengthened his convictions, which will be found admirably expressed in his well-known book On the Threshold of the Unseen. Sir Oliver Lodge, fortunately, is still with us and loses no opportunity of proclaiming his beliefs. He may now be enjoying the satisfaction of having the intellectual world sitting at big feet, and accepting the results of his many years of research. I think, however, that he is too modest a man to find such enjoyment, though he would hardly be human if he, like Barrett, greatest care and accuracy, made him especially suitable for this research work, as his training had made him scrupulously accurate in all he undertook. Edward C. Randall of Buffalo, with whom I stayed when I was in America some years ago, has, however, been the most fortunate of all the investigators into this great subject, as he experimented for over 20 years with one of the most highly developed direct voice mediums, Mrs. Emily S. French. This lady was under his careful observation during all these years, living much of the time in his own house in Buffalo. Investigations took place several times each week, and Randall, from open skepticism and disbelief, gradually, under the force of the evidence which accumulated, became convinced, as many others have done before and after, not only of the genuineness of the phenomena but also that the voices were produced by those who once lived here on Earth. On over 700 nights, he told me, covering a period of 22 years, in his own house, under scientific conditions, he talked for hours on end with those the world thought dead. Randall is not a man to be easily convinced, or to be the subject of trickery. He is one of the leading lawyers in the United States, and besides that, he was, when I met him, president of several important industrial undertakings, one of which is the American Superpower Company, which supplies New York with electric light and power. This practical, level-headed lawyer, accustomed to the sifting of evidence and detection of fraud, has published the result of his investigations in several books, the principal of which is entitled The Dead Have Never Died. Those interested in the religious and philosophical side will find this well expressed in Kathleen, by my old friend the Reverend John Lomond, D.D., the biographer of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who, since 1878, has based his preaching on his wide experience of psychic phenomena. He is one of the pioneers among the clergy in his effort to bring orthodox religion into line with this new science. Human Personality and It's Survival of Bodily Death, by F. W. H. Myers, into volumes, and covering 700 pages in length, but now published in an abridged edition, was the outcome of a great scholar's life of research, and was the textbook of the science at the beginning of this century. Much progress in understanding the laws governing the phenomena has, however, been made since its publication, but its carefully grouped records of cases in all the different departments of the science will, for long, stand as a monument of painstaking and careful research. I have given a brief summary of some of the leading men interested in this great subject of the survival of death, but there are many others who have done much to further our knowledge on the subject. These men were the pioneers who have penetrated into the borderland of this newly discovered country, and brought back to their fellow travelers towards this land they will all someday reach, many vital facts pertaining to their destination. The reports of the earlier pioneers were received with scorn and ridicule. But, undaunted, they insisted on the truth of their reports. Others went to seek this newfound land and came back with the same news. So it went on, year after year, until at length unbelief gradually broke down, and the multitude then asked for more and still more information from the growing band of pioneers who had ventured on ahead. One of the most recent and distinguished who has gone some further distance ahead of his contemporaries, and has had the courage to proclaim his discoveries, is Dr. Ajay Tilyard, FRS, entomologist in chief to the Commonwealth of Australia. He became convinced a few years ago of the reality of psychic phenomena, in consequence of certain investigations he made in this country and America. He was not slow to tell his fellow scientists that his discoveries had changed his outlook on life and the world in general, and that the sooner official science began a serious investigation into psychical phenomena, the better it would be for science and the world at large. That his pronouncements made a considerable impression among the diehards of the old materialistic school became quickly apparent, and, on the eve of his departure home to Australia, he had the satisfaction of hearing from the lips of Sir Richard Gregory, the editor of Nature, words of great encouragement. This occurred at a private luncheon given in his honour by the National Laboratory for Psychical Research, conducted by Harry Price, at which I was privileged to be present. Sir Richard, in the course of some highly appreciative references to Dr. Tilyard, spoke of him as having lighted a candle which had not yet been put out. I mention this incident so as to emphasise again that the pioneers have done their work well, and that official science and orthodox religion, where the worship of the past still reigns, are gradually, but nevertheless surely, moving in the direction in which psychic knowledge is leading them. Certainly the day is not far distant when those who deny the reality of psychic phenomena will be accounted foolish and ignorant. Dr. Crandon, of Lime Street, Boston, USA, furnished me with the results of a private sitting held in Boston, at which the only person present was Dr. Tilyard. The medium was Dr. Crandon's wife, known to all psychic students as Marjorie. I have not space at my disposal to deeply into the precautions taken to prevent fraud, and the results achieved, but one can say emphatically that everything possible was done to prevent the medium being responsible for what occurred. Dr. Tilyard was present with her in a locked room in the dark. Prior to the light being put out, and the door locked, the medium was securely fastened to her chair by means of adhesive tape bandages, the ends of which were marked by blue pencil, which blue markings were continued onto the medium's skin. If she had moved, it would have been seen afterwards that the blue markings were out of place, but at the end of the seance they were in their correct place. It was physically impossible, therefore, for the medium to be responsible for what occurred. During the seance, first of all thumb marks, whose markings did not resemble the thumb marks of either of the two present, were obtained on various pieces of soft wax, and later in the seance an independent voice, claiming to be the medium's brother, carried on an animated conversation with Dr. Tilyard. That it was independent and apart from the medium, and not her voice, was proved by the fact that during the time this voice was speaking, the voice cutout machine was attached to the medium's mouth. This machine is a device which has been invented to make it impossible for a medium, when it is in use, to speak. Therefore, when it is in use, if another voice speaks, it cannot be the medium's voice. Dr. Tilyard's comments on this private sitting, which was held on 10 August 1928, are contained in a letter he wrote to Sir Oliver Lodge, dated 11th of August 1928, of which the following are the most important items. They are taken from psychic research.